This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 135.
So somewhere between the 1980s and now, Brussels sprouts got a new marketing manager, right? Because when I was a kid, no one was talking about Brussels sprouts. You were forced to eat them. Now, if you go to a restaurant, it's very common that Brussels sprouts will be there as an appetizer, and they will be charred, and they will be in a balsamic glaze, and they will have bacon or prosciutto, and you will get them as an appetizer to split with the table. Imagine doing that 30 years ago. That's unfathomable. Similarly, skills. Well, technology has advanced, and it has helped us, and it's helped us do this faster, and it has helped us give good UI tools for users to use it, meaning like the actual person in the job to understand it, the managers of the job to understand it, the HR business partner to understand it. The technology has advanced so much that we're able to now use this data in a faster, more effective way than we were ever able to use it before. Yes, some of these technology organizations have taken the Brussels sprout, they've charred them, they put balsamic glaze on it, and suddenly these people want it in a way they didn't want it before when we were just selling boiled Brussels sprouts. They want it now. You're saying, yes, yes, we're ready to go. We know how to do this, and we do agree this is the right thing to do.
How can you take a human-first approach to skills-based learning? Why should you have a clear business case before implementing skills-based talent initiatives?
Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level.
Imagine having direct access to 18 world-class thought leaders who will elevate and transform how you think about HR. As many of you know, late last year, I launched Elevate, a three-week virtual development experience that over 100 HR leaders attended and participants described as a master's degree in HR at a fraction of the cost and by far the most engaging learning experience in years. Elevate 2025 returns on May 20th, and it's specifically designed to elevate HR business partners and Center of Excellence professionals' strategic capabilities and business impact. Who will you learn from at Elevate? We're talking Dave Ulrich on the next agenda for HR, Muriel Wilkins on breaking through limiting beliefs, Mark Efron on connecting talent philosophy to business strategy, plus sessions on AI-driven process redesign, agile HR, top team effectiveness, operating model transformation, how to communicate like an executive, what your CEO actually wants from HR, and how to get your expertise actually used. Every session is designed with the goal of helping you to take your business acumen, strategic thinking, influence, and coaching capabilities to the next level. Also, the 16 interactive sessions include live Q&A, where your specific challenges and questions get addressed by the expert themselves. And with recorded sessions and slides available afterwards, you don't have to worry about missing a session, or even better, you and your team can revisit these insights again and again. So what are you waiting for? Register now or learn more at www.elevate2025.vip/nextgenhr or go to futureofhr.com. But hurry, as early bird pricing is available for only a limited time. Don't miss this once-a-year chance to transform your capabilities and career at Elevate 2025. And with that, my guest this week is Christina Norris Watts. Christina is the head of assessment and people practices at Johnson & Johnson, where she is leading a skills-inclusive approach to learning, hiring, and talent management. With a PhD in industrial organizational psychology and over 20 years in talent management, Christina brings both academic rigor and practical expertise to her work. Under her leadership, J&J has increased transparency across the organization, allowing employees to explore career paths based on skills mapping and empowering them to see exactly what skills they need to move to new roles and grow their career. As Christina puts it, their method is skills inclusive rather than simply skills based, because they consider the whole person, including experiences, aspirations, and personal traits, not just technical capabilities. This is a great conversation, and I learned so much from Christina about what it really takes to implement skills-based talent initiatives. I know you're going to enjoy this as we discussed why Christina says transitioning to a skills-based organization is like eating your Brussels sprouts, the strategic approach Johnson & Johnson took to implement skills-based talent initiatives across the organization, how the J&J Credo helped shape their distinctive human-first strategy for creating personalized learning and development paths, the way J&J's innovative learning platform successfully integrates the three E's, experience, exposure, and education, and advice for HR leaders beginning their skills journey, including where to start and challenges to avoid, and so much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Christina. Christina, how are you? And welcome to the Future of HR podcast.
Thanks, JP. I'm so excited to be here. I'm just thrilled to be invited to talk to you today.
I'm excited to have you on the podcast. You're doing some amazing work at Johnson & Johnson, and I really wanted to bring you on after hearing all the great things you were doing. But let's start a little bit and talk about your current role at J&J. You said it's your dream job, and just tell us more about why you feel this way and you're not just sucking up to your boss, who's also been on the podcast. But I do know and believe this really, truly is your dream job at Johnson & Johnson. Tell us why.
It really is. And it isn't just my love for Michael or for Peter, who were great guests on your show. So I have the privilege of being the head of assessment and people practices within global talent management at J&J. Obviously, what every little girl dreams of being when she grows up, right? The reason I call it my dream job is I get to study everyone else's job at J&J. And there are such cool jobs at Johnson & Johnson. We have folks in the lab synthesizing new molecules. We have folks devising robotic surgical arms for surgeons to use. We have folks in transportation, which you might not think is the most exciting job, but let me tell you why it is. In transportation, who are figuring out the logistics of getting your biological material through our whole supply chain process and back to you. And they know exactly where it is at any second. It is so cool, the advances they're making. And when I think about our assessment strategy, our skills strategy, our people practices strategy, I get to think about every single job at J&J and how we are going to measure people to make sure they're successful in the job, how we're going to help them grow, how we're going to figure out who the best next leader is going to be. And that is such a puzzle to do for 130,000 employees. And I love a puzzle. So I do something different at work every single day. I have to figure out how to make this all work. And it's such a challenge and such an exciting challenge that I get to do.
Oh, yeah. I can see why it'd be a dream job. Johnson & Johnson is an incredible company. But you're right. The variety of roles. I mean, I didn't even really think about all those different jobs they have and the complexity, but the impact you can have when you're thinking about this from a talent perspective. And I know we're going to talk a lot about these skills-based talent initiatives that you've been working with on the team. And I think that's what people were very much interested to hear more about. But I think Johnson & Johnson is unique because you guys have a credo. And part of that credo says that each person must be considered as an individual. And so I'm curious, how has that philosophy shaped your approach to doing skills-based talent initiatives?
Okay, I'm so glad you asked. Very good job quoting our credo. So our credo, if people aren't aware of it, it's a four-paragraph document that was written by Robert Wood Johnson that is really the foundation for everything we do at J&J. It has been in place for a very long time. Every J&J employee is familiar with the credo. We take our credo responsibilities very, very seriously. And in the second paragraph, which talks about our responsibilities to our employees, it says each person must be considered as an individual. And the reason that's so important when I talk about skills is sometimes when I do a lot of research externally about skills, it follows this path of, hey, if you can figure out all the skills that your employees have, you can just organize your whole company thinking about the skills and skills level. And you don't have to think about people anymore. You get to think about just this collection of skills. And I am here to tell you that we are not just a collection of skills. We are a collection of individuals. And those individuals bring a lot more than just skills to the job. They bring their past experiences, what they've done. They bring their future hopes and dreams, what they want to do. They bring their trait, their drivers, right? Who they are that we measure psychometrically pretty well. We've been measuring for a while. They bring their good days and their bad days and their relationships with other people. They bring it all. And if we're going to think about how our workforce is going to be successful in the future, we have to understand that, yes, we're going to do a lot with skills. We're going to figure out how to measure skills, but there's so much more to a person than just skills. And it's important. And in fact, we have an obligation and a responsibility to think about you more than just a collection of skills in order for you to succeed. So we don't discount those other things in favor of skills. We want to measure them all. We want them all to work together and then help have that help you advance your own career. So that's what we call now our whole person model. It's a little academic to give the model a name. So you'll forgive me and my IO background for doing that. I don't need everybody to know that we call it the whole person model. I just need them to feel that they are being treated and respected as an individual.
It's so well said. And I really like the whole person model, maybe because I have a PhD in IO psych as well. And we like to label things. But when we talk about skills, sometimes we get into this sort of lowest common denominator and this like myopic focus of skills. Like it's going to change everything when, to your point, we are a whole person. Individuals, we are more than just our skill set, and we may have conflicting skills potentially as a personality. We may have different aspirations. To start to break us down to skills and tasks, it starts to feel very just reductive and not fair to who we really are as people. And I think we all want to be seen as individuals. So I love that you're talking about this. Now, the other thing you said that I just loved, and I was like, okay, I have to have Christina on the podcast, is you said that this transition to a skills-based organization is like eating your Brussels sprouts. And so I see this already going to be on t-shirts, but truly, this is so funny. You say skills-based organizations is like eating your Brussels sprouts. So tell us more why you say this.
So somewhere between the 1980s and now, Brussels sprouts got a new marketing manager. Right? Because when I was a kid, no one was talking about Brussels sprouts. You were forced to eat them. Now, if you go to a restaurant, it's very common that Brussels sprouts will be there as an appetizer and they will be charred and they will be in a balsamic glaze and they will have bacon or prosciutto and you will get them as an appetizer to split with the table. Imagine doing that 30 years ago. That's unfathomable. Similarly, skills. So if you're old enough to remember KSAOs, when we used to do job analysis and define a job, we'd say what tasks are needed on the jobs and what are the knowledge, skills, abilities, and other characteristics that are needed to perform that job. And IO psychologists would come in and they would say, you should do this job analysis and you should figure this out so that you can really, really need it on the job. And we have been saying that for decades and decades and decades. And people didn't want to do it. They really didn't want to eat the Brussels sprouts. They're like, that seems like a lot of work. And oh, by the way, as soon as you do it, it's out of date. Like it takes you so long to measure the job and then it's out of date. Or you measure the job and then you give me this huge spreadsheet of 500 skills per job, KSAOs, excuse me, per job. And what am I supposed to do with it? And as a consultant, I face that. You probably face similar things. It was tricky. It was out of date immediately, and it was very tricky to figure out the overlap between jobs and the intersection between jobs and how are we doing with that? Well, technology has advanced, and it has helped us, and it's helped us do this faster, and it has helped us give good UI tools for users to use it, meaning like the actual person in the job to understand it, the managers of the job to understand it, the HR business partner to understand it. The technology has advanced so much that we're able to now use this data in a faster, more effective way than we were ever able to use it before. And so now we have business leaders in our organization coming to us saying, hey, I think we should really figure out the skills needed for success in the job. I heard this really good podcast the other week, and we need to figure out the skills needed for success in the job and then hire people based on that, or make sure we're training people based on that, or make sure people are aware of the skills there. And it frustrates me when my colleagues in IO Psych hear that and say, we've been telling you that for 30 years. Why didn't you listen to us before? And I'm like, no, that's not the answer. The answer is, what a great idea. And thank goodness I have the skills and experience to do that for you. I know how to do that for you. You want to spend $1 million figuring out the skills for your job? That's brilliant. I love to hear it. I'm ready to go. Yes, some of these technology organizations have taken the Brussels sprout, they've charred them, they've put balsamic glaze on it, and suddenly these people want it in a way they didn't want it before when we were just selling boiled Brussels sprouts. They want it now. You're saying, yes, yes, we're ready to go. We know how to do this, and we do agree this is the right thing to do.
Well, I think this is a great analogy, and you're right. Technology's come a long way where this is easier to do. It's more effective. It can be more predictive. We can use it in different ways. I still think there's a lot of work to get to a skills-based organization. I'm sure you guys have gone through that. This isn't something that is easy. So just because we're saying that now their Brussels sprouts are tasty doesn't mean they're easy to prepare, right? There's still work to get into a skills-based organization or skills-based talent initiatives, I would refer to it. But let's talk about the journey you guys have been on, because I want to hear about some of the challenges and the successes. You've had both. But talk more about this innovative work you're doing at J&J related to skills and the journey you guys have gone on to have the success you're having.
Great question. And yes, you're exactly right that preparing the Brussels sprouts is still not easy. Our journey started with learning. So our learning organization under our new chief learning officer was really looking at how do we do personalized learning for our 130,000 employees. Everybody wants their own Netflix type experience. I already talked about the variety of jobs we have. So boy, those learning needs are going to be really different. How do we make sure we have the right learning resources? Well, to try to help, we wanted to make sure that we had learning resources associated with the right skills. And what were the skills? We're getting really concrete and really precise. What were the precise skills we wanted people to learn? How do we help people prioritize those skills? And when I say prioritize, I mean like the 1 to 2 things you want to do better on, not the 10 to 20 things you want to do better on. That doesn't get you anywhere. That gets you to abandon your New Year's resolution within the first 4 weeks, right? And so we worked arm in arm with our learning organization to say, hey, we need to figure out what skills are, and then we can help people grow those specific skills. So we have been on this journey of helping to give some language and define what skills are needed. How do we help leaders prioritize and communicate that to their businesses in terms of what skills they're going to need for the future? And then how do we use those skills? So how does someone upskill themselves? How does someone get better at something? How do we use that hiring? How do we use that in our talent talks and our planning? And how do we keep going in that? So that's been a bit of our journey, but it was really what really pushed us fast was this need for learning and this need for personalized learning.
Yeah, I think that is so important. And I think it's a really good use case for skills. Yeah. One that I feel more organizations should be going after. But I have a question, I think probably everyone's mind. The first step, I believe, when you think about going to a skills-based talent initiatives is to actually document the skills, right? Yeah. How do you get the skill ontology? How did you do that for 130,000 folks? What is the process to actually get these skills into whatever database, whatever technology you're going to use to then leverage for personalized learning?
One of our first guiding principles that I learned very early on in this work was that I did not want to manage the dictionary. I have no interest in managing the dictionary. I talked about how my dream job, like that would be the opposite of my dream job. I said, I don't think it makes sense for J&J to have their own skills dictionary. I think we should buy a dictionary, and I think we should pay a partner to help us manage the dictionary. Because by the way, there's new technical skills that appear on a pretty regular basis. Mm-hmm. So this dictionary of skills or this ontology of skills, you can get at a distance, which is really nice, really needs love every day. And it needs caretaking every day. And I don't want to be the one doing that. I want a partner to help me do that. So we went out and we searched for vendor partners who were really thinking about skills the same way we were. And specifically, I was very clear that I needed skills that had definitions. So not just a list of words, but skills with definitions, because if I'm going to measure them later, I need to know what the construct is I'm measuring. Secondly, I needed skills that had proficiency levels, because again, if I'm going to measure you on them later, I need proficiency level. And if I'm going to say, hey, this job needs this skill, I'm going to need to know what proficiency level. And third, I needed skills that were linked to your job. And I meant linked to job in a way validated, using a legal definition of that validation to make sure that those were really the critical skills needed to be successful in a job. Those three criteria actually narrowed what was out there in the market pretty effectively to start. And the market keeps changing pretty rapidly, but that helped us say, okay, and then this is going to be ontology, and then this is going to be our governance of our ontology. Are there specific things we're going to need to add for Jinjie? Yeah, of course there are. Of course there are. Are there some skills that we're never going to need to have? Yeah, sure. We don't do a lot with veterinary science. We don't do a lot with aerospace exploration. We don't need those kinds of things, right? So sure, are there tweaks? Yes. But we really needed a partner, and we really needed a partner who understood the criteria we had for what our skill ontology needed to be.
That's smart. So in a lot of ways, breaking this work up, which could have been daunting and really, frankly, time intensive, and you don't have the capability or the tech to do that, made a lot of sense, especially in that piece on the ontologies and understanding the skills and mapping that. I think that's really helpful for everyone. I think you talked a little bit about this, but go into more of the success, because you've had a lot of success with this personalized learning, and maybe you could, what you can share. I know some of this maybe you can't share as much, but I'd love to hear a little more about how this has been successful, because I've heard it has been really, really successful for J&J. And then I want to talk a little more on the flip side of what hasn't been as successful and maybe some lessons learned as well around skills.
J&J Learn is our product that's available to every employee at J&J where they can access learning. And what's been really successful about that is it all rolled out as one nice integrated service for the employee. So it starts with reflection. And when we say start with reflection, we say, where are you now? And we don't just ask you about your skills, back to the whole person model. We ask you about what drives you, what motivates you, what you want to do next, what you're thinking about in terms of your next job, and we ask you about your skills. The reason we focus so much on skills is back to my puzzle pieces. It's not a really complicated puzzle for me to solve to figure out what you want to do next. To measure that, I just ask you what you want to do next, and then you tell me and I believe you. Now, I can provide some guidance because I think actually that question's pretty hard. What do you want to do next? And there's some guidance and we can provide some measurement. But once you give me an answer, I believe you. There's no verification needed. It's not a really interesting assessment puzzle versus skills makes for a much more interesting assessment puzzle. So we start with reflection, and that reflection piece, really, we try to get the person to focus on, okay, and then what do you want to learn? And then when they've determined what they want to learn and why they want to learn it, then we have so many resources built out for them that aren't just education resources, right? So the model to grow a person we have are the three E's: education, experience, and exposure. And so, yeah, we have a lot of LinkedIn Learning courses you can take if you want to learn prompt engineering. But we have a lot of other courses you can learn if you want to learn prompt engineering. But what might be more useful for you if you really want to get better at your prompt engineering is to find a gig where you get to do some prompt engineering with someone who knows more about prompt engineering. So we have a whole gig platform integrated, and that's based on skills, and it talks about the skills you're going to learn in the gig. We also have a mentoring platform connected to that too, where you can find a mentor to help you with that particular skill. And I use prompt engineering as an example, but it's not just technical skills. And in fact, some of our mentoring relationships are more based on the leadership skills, some of the building relationship skills, some of the networking skills that sometimes people struggle with and are trickier to learn. Because by the way, not all skills are created equal. So if you're learning pivot tables, I can get you from a zero to an awareness level of pivot tables pretty quickly, right? If you want to be a better inclusive leader and you've been leading people for 10 years that you want to really be that expert level, all right, that may take you another 10 years to learn. That can be a really demotivating message if said the wrong way. So it's really important that we have all these different types of resources that we talk about that. And that has, I think, really led to our success because we have all of this connected for the employee to play around with.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. I love the three E's: experience, education, exposure. I think I got those right. Sounds sort of like the 70-20-10.
Yeah.
Good reframe. But I think it's great. And I like that you guys have branded that. I really love the gig work. I really think we do not do enough to help people find experiences that help them learn the skills. We talk a lot about going to a class versus go do it. And it just goes back to like, how did you learn how to ride a bike? Did you read a PowerPoint deck or did you watch a YouTube video? Or did you just get on a bike and fall down 10 times until you figured it out? And we have to do more of riding bikes in HR and getting people to have those experiences. So I love you're doing the gig work. And a lot of companies are trying to make that much more part of their learning development. Let's talk about, on the flip side, you've had some challenges where you tried to implement skills-based talent initiatives and the results were not what you hoped. What are some limitations you've seen or things that people need to think about as they start to implement skills-based initiatives?
One of the really interesting challenges that we faced was the impetus for the whole person model. So what I mean by that is when we focus so much on skills and we're trying to solve the problem of skills, that was interpreted at times as we were ignoring everything else, that we didn't care about anything else. Now, I come from a hiring background, talent acquisition. My background is selection assessment. That's where I cut my teeth, and that's kind of my first love. And that floored me because, of course, I care about other things. You could have the strongest logical reasoning skills in the world, but you're a licensed to practice law in the state of New Jersey. I'm not hiring you to be a lawyer in New Jersey. I'm just not. Of course, other things matter. And so it's the communication and change management of this is so critical because as we talked about skills and skills and skills and skills and skills, people heard and only skills, which is not what we ever said or ever meant. So we've had to do a lot of work to say like, hey, yeah, no, it's just that we already know how to measure your experiences. We look at your resume. We already know how to measure aspirations. We ask you what they are. And then we're going to put all that together in the hiring process, right? So as we embark more on skills-based hiring that we're looking for, what we really mean by that is, hey, be really clear, hiring manager and recruiter, on what skills are going to lead to success in that job. Be really clear about that because you're only going to get to measure 4 or 5 skills in the hiring process, maybe. Usually you don't get the luxury of months-long hiring processes. So what do you want to prioritize? What do you want to measure? What's going to lead to success in the job? And yeah, and then we're going to help you measure that from a skills-based perspective. Probably going to help you measure it with an interview question. We're still going to help you measure it. But it's all those together. And that has been a really surprising challenge for me throughout this process, that people thought we were then going to ignore other pieces of the person, which was never the intention.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're really kind of making the point of just having a much more big picture view of this and not myopic on one solution, which again, I think that happens when things like skills-based organizations have become a pretty big trend. And there's a lot of hype around them. And so I think people start to over-rotate like we found a silver bullet, which we have not, because a lot of it's the same. And the hiring process, Christina, I'd love to hear your perspective because I know this is one of your passions and expertise. As we think about hiring people using skills, I have two questions for you. One, how do we really validate someone has skills? Frankly, across the board, learning development feels less risky to me because, hey, I'm developing myself and I may think I'm good at this. I may think I'm bad at this, whatever. Doesn't really matter. I'm working on my own skill set. But if we start talking about things like promotions or hiring someone based on their skills and a skills assessment, now we have legal issues. We've got maybe self-bias issues that we're not very good at understanding how good we are, et cetera. We always overestimate how good we are, right?
Yeah.
How do you think about that in terms of skills with hiring and things like promotion?
Yeah. I'm going to add an additional wrinkle to your problem to make it even a bigger problem. Yes, we overestimate our skills, but also like men overestimate their skill more than women do, which could put then women at a disadvantage.
Absolutely.
And so 100%. I think it goes back to, okay, so the robustness of your measurement depends on what you want to use it for at the end. So to your point, if I just want you to have some information about yourself that you're going to use for your own development, I can say, hey, self-assess, or I can even assume the skills you have based on your job. That's good enough data. If I am wanting to know your skill level to really think about, hey, what's your next job, whether that's selection or promotion? What's your next job in the future? What's your pay going to be based on those skills? There's not a world where I'm going to rely on your self-assessment. Don't be crazy. I might start there. I might start there, right? If I'm sourcing you for a role and I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile, that's self-assessment. What you've said you've done, that's self-assessment. So what I'm going to do next as a recruiter or a sourcer is I'm going to call you up and I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm going to ask you some questions about what you've done. I'm going to interview you. I'm going to verify, hopefully based on a structured interview rubric that has a scoring that's been validated by someone like me. And I'm going to verify, hey, this is what we think you have. If you're a current employee and we're going to think about your promotion, well, we're going to look at what does your manager think of these skills, right? Does your manager say you have these skills? The people who know these skills, have they seen those skills? Have we seen them demonstrated in the workplace? So that's not totally different from what we do today. I want to call out. Sometimes people get really wrapped up in, but how are we going to verify? And I'm like, well, today we hire people. Today we promote people. Today we pay people. How do we verify it? We look at manager ratings. You might look at peer ratings. And you talk about like, okay, so does this person seem to have this? Maybe in the hiring process, you do a work sample. I love a work sample. Always more predictive than an interview. I love a work sample so much. Or you could have intern programs where they work for you for 3 months and then you make a hiring decision at the end if that's even better because then you have real world observations. Are you going to have an objective test? There are some nice objective tests that are coming that are skill based. Those are great. Those are really great from an assessment perspective. I just always like to caution that reminder, human beings don't usually like taking tests. So how often are you going to do that? That can be used in the hiring process, but it's not necessarily great. All your talent processes. But it all goes back to, how robust does the measurement need to be for what use case you want to use it for?
Yeah. And right now I'm just loving it because we're really getting into some IO psych behavior, especially around selection. Just going down the list of like, basically from like low correlation to success in hiring to higher correlation for the flex of your job. So I love that you did that, but I think we're not doing enough of that. And so my question on this one though, I agree. You're right. We are hiring people today on skills. We're not calling it that. Yeah. Hopefully we have some kind of rubric. Often we don't really, but we think there's a few really key experiences that kind of come out for a hiring manager, et cetera. But that is kind of a similar view. So help me understand, Christina, from your perspective, how skills in some ways is not kind of old wine in a new bottle, because now what you're saying is you're right. We have skills. We have a cool technology that's helping us at least identify this. Maybe it's giving us interview guide questions, hopefully a good rubric with some questions there to assess it. But I'm still using human judgment in the interview process to make a decision on selection? Or are you think we're going further?
Are we going further? I have wanted to pilot assessment-based hiring without interviews for years, for decades. When we have data that says work samples are more predictive, when we have data that says this test is more predictive, I would love to try it. I haven't found a single hiring manager who's willing to hire without an interview. I also think there is, and that might be different for some high volume jobs. Perhaps we don't have the high volume jobs that'd be different for us. So perhaps there are some jobs out there where that makes a lot of sense. You just have a cut score and a test. The test measures the skill and you just go forward. I do think there's a proliferation of regulations that are coming or that are out there on automated decision-making that were intended to get at AI decisions, but are sweeping up non-AI decisions in their automated decision making. So for that, I'm referring to like the New York City law, the California privacy protection. I'm expecting to see more and more state regulations in this area. I think there's the importance of the human is not to be underestimated. As flawed as we are, we still trust us more than we trust that computer and more than we trust the score. And frankly, even as an assessment person, I love assessment. I found a perfect test. If I found a perfect test, I would tell you, I would say, just use this test, hire someone, hire this leader, predicts leadership perfectly. Great. But no, we don't have that.
For some people, they'd say we are now using skills-based hiring.
Yeah.
hopefully that means we've identified the skills really critical for that role. And now we're asking great questions around that to validate those that are behavioral in nature. That's the goal. This is sort of the crux of the issue where it feels like certain roles, skills-based talent initiatives make a lot of sense, and certain roles where it doesn't, and it's more challenging.
Well, let me take a step back. So that's how I define skills-based hiring. I will say other people define skills-based hiring differently. So I don't think I have the corner on that, meaning sometimes when people talk about skills-based hiring, they mean that we're not going to look at the degree you have. We're not going to look at college degree. That is a really interesting conversation because college degree has always been a proxy for other things. But college degree is an important part in large corporations hiring because it's an easy way to screen out candidates. Is it a biased way to screen out candidates? Sure is. If we can get at the skills rather than just the degree, could we reduce bias? Sure, if our skills measurement also isn't biased. That's the part people miss sometimes. Like, okay, so now we're going to have the skills. Okay, well now, instead of having 500 applicants for the job, you have 1,000 applicants because you didn't have that bachelor degree screen, which still might be the right thing to do. Okay, but now you do need to screen them based on skills. What are you going to do? You're going to give them an objective test? All right, is that objective test going to be any less biased than the degree requirement you had? And so that's a fascinating conversation that is not nearly as black and white as some people make it out to be.
Excellent point. And this is partly why there's just so much noise around skills-based. It's a very complex topic. Implementation is not easy. And there's different ways to do it. Frankly, with, I think, how organizations decide of the quality decisions they're trying to make with the skills-based and their risk profile comes down to that in some ways and what they're really trying to do. Personally, you know, my point of view on this, I think it's amazing for what you're doing around personalized learning and development. And I think that's a huge win for skills-based talent initiatives. I'm a little bit more jury's out on the others. I think there's a lot of work and I'm not sure the juice is worth the squeeze, to quote Mark Efron's article around the skills-based work. But let me ask you one last
question. Can I tell you one thing where it has been helpful for us? Because I did love his article. And I'll tell you, I agreed with so much of it in terms of like, please don't go out with like, hey, we're going to have skills. Step one, define skills. Step two, ? Step three, profit. There is that out there in the market that you have to be careful about. He's exactly right about that. What's been really helpful for us is having a common language of skills across J&J is something we had never had before. So when we had competency models before, procurement, finance, and HR all had a competency called financial acumen, and it was all defined differently. It was a totally different construct. It was called the same thing. What has helped us from our skill ontology perspective is now we have a language that is the same language no matter where you sit in the organization. That has been a really nice win when we think about mobility internally and helping the employee understand what is really needed on that next job. That's been huge.
That's a game changer. It makes a lot of sense how that'd be super helpful. It's also for hiring, for the people leaders and managers to understand as well. Having that common framework is great. So I think that makes a lot of sense. And that's powerful. And we tried to do all this 20 years ago or whatever, 10 years ago by hand with competency models.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it gets complicated. And that's why they would just die under their own weight. It was like, this is insane. We can't keep updating. So I love how your approach, very smart approach, Christina. So what advice do you have for HR leaders who are just beginning their skills journey? Like, where should they start? If you had the opportunity to do this again, what would you do differently?
Whenever I am talking to someone who is just starting, I do ask, what do you want to achieve at the end? Because your end state is probably not, now I have a list of skills. Because if that is your end state, you just want a list of skills, congratulations, you're done. Just go buy one. You have it. You have a list of skills. You're done. Your end state is probably something like all employees know where to go to find their next job at your company. And employees look at your company first before another company. Or is your end state, we hire based on what we know leads to success for the job? Or is your end state, we have the best leaders in the world that people who don't work for us yet want to work for? If that's your end state, figure out what your end state is. And, oh, and by the way, back to prioritization, you only get to pick one end state. So meaning you don't get to pick the leader one and the hiring one at the same time. Because your hiring system is probably very different from your leadership development programs. And you have to figure out where you're going to spend your effort. I mean, unless you got a team of 50 people helping you on the skill stuff, you got to figure out what you're going after first. Okay, how are skills going to help you do that so that you can prove it out? So that you can prove it out. Because it's not, skills are not an end by themselves. It's this talent practice. Whatever that talent practice or that talent problem you're trying to solve is. And companies do this so differently. Like a lot of, some companies do start with hiring. Some companies like us start with learning. Some companies start with workforce planning. It's fascinating where they start with because they all have different issues. That's fine. But you start somewhere and figure out what your end state is and then how skills will help you do that and then design to that. Yes, keep the other ones in mind that you know you're going to do next so that you don't build something that will break when you try to use it for something else. But start there with what's your use case that you're going to be able to demonstrate to people like, hey, then we had some value. We did bring personalized learning to everybody.
I love it. So helpful, really important. I think always going back to what is the business problem you're solving and how can a technology or other process like skills-based talent initiatives really help? Christina, last question for you to ask all guests. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I love this question and I've been really thinking about it. So my word or phrase is human-centric. Let me tell you how I got there. First, I asked our generative AI tool your question. And we said, what's the one word or phrase? It did not come up with human-centric, let me be clear. It came up with data-driven decision-making, which is great. But then I was like, why? Why did you come up with data-driven decision-making? And it said, well, because the future of HR is being shaped by the ability to gather and analyze workforce data, right? And we're just talking about this. We're going to have data on all our employees, data on all our jobs. We're going to use that to make decisions. And I was like, yes, but the person making the decision is a person. As I was thinking about that, I was like, that's true. And big sigh, people are becoming more and more aware that their data is being commoditized and their data is really valuable. For them to give me the permission to use their data, they got to have a lot of trust in me as an organization. And there's more and more regulation. In the EU first with the EU AI Act, there's more stuff we're seeing, like I said, at a state level. There's going to limit actually what HR can do with data, what they should be doing with data. Every people analytics function should be asking all the time with if they should be doing something, even if they can do it. That ethical use of data is critical. And all that goes back to me to human-centric. Am I treating you as an individual? Am I fully respecting your dignity as an employee? Am I using your data responsibly to help you? Yes, and to help me, but also to help you. So I think the human centricity and putting the human at the center of it all is really going to become more and more important, particularly if we want to continue to get more data from people.
Christina, I love it. Human centric. I love how you brought that back to really thinking about each person as an individual, not just skills. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Christina for sharing her insights and journey to build a skills-inclusive learning platform. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And we'll be back next week with Lucrecia Borgonavo, Chief Talent and Organizational Effectiveness Officer at MasterCard. And joining Lucrecia is Michael Linnartz, Executive Vice President, Total Rewards at MasterCard. And in my conversation with Lucrecia and Michael, they're going to share how they've been working together to redesign the performance management and compensation processes at MasterCard, reinforce the behaviors associated with what they call the MasterCard way. This is a great conversation and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.